In between the covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Gigi, Dan, Karen, and Susie for joining us at KBOO, and for all of you for listening.
You better watch out for the eggplant that ate Chicago. If he's still hungry, the whole country's doomed. Well, it's in trouble. If he's still hungry, the whole country's doomed. Wackadoo, wackadoo.
You know you love KBOO's programming, but did you know you can help inform decisions about new programs on KBOO, support evaluating shows to ensure programming excellence, as well as help process feedback about shows from our listeners? Well, you can when you join the KBOO Programming Advisory Committee. All you need to be is a KBOO member. Attend monthly meetings on the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. at KBOO, and commit 5 hours a month to work on committee-related tasks. The Programming Advisory Committee works alongside KBOO programming staff to live out our programming charter. You can find out more at kboo.fm/committees. See you the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. KBOO needs you.
Good morning, and welcome to the October edition of Black Book Talk. My name is Patricia Welch. I'm the library lady, and with me is my colleague,
Obi Hill of Black Book Talk.
And we are delighted to welcome to Black Book Talk Dr. Joe Remsen, who is the author of The African-American Male School Adaptability Crisis, Its Source and Solution, Planted in the African-American Garden of Eden. Dr. Remsen, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for inviting me on your program. I'm delighted to be with you.
Okay. As I, we talked a little bit earlier, and I said that we'd like you to read a passage from the book. But before you do that, could you just kind of briefly give us a summary of the intention of the book? This is a big old book, but we're going to ask you for just a brief summary before you get into reading your passage.
Okay. Let me tell you what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to say to my fellow African-American males that we have a problem, a crisis, when it comes to our sons. And that crisis is that not enough of them are completing high school and going to college. Instead, they have been captured by the streets and by activities that take them in a different direction and does great harm to themselves, to their families, and to our race. And we need to do something about it, and we can do something about it. We can design educational programs that will enable them to get careers and acquire the skills that they need to go out and earn a good living and to establish families and themselves turn out sons who will be a credit to them and to the race. And this book is an appeal to black males for us to kind of make that happen. And my belief is that we can if we focus them on career acquisition and on character development so that they will have those qualities that are needed to be successful in school as well as in life.
Okay.
And my thesis is that the reason that hasn't happened is that we haven't provided them the environments that we ought to.
Okay. See,
we have to have them provide them a nurturing environment so that they will come up and acquire those attributes that will enable them to do exactly what I've described. That's a pretty long-winded short answer. Right?
No, it's really not. Okay, but all right. So could you now read a passage that just gives us an example of how you address this in the book?
Well, this is a kind of a conclusion. I might not be, but let me give you a sense. I'll just read it, and this will be long too. We can conceive of the dream of which Booker T. Washington and Dr. King spoke as follows. Yes, inevitably, we having our own subcultural identity, only a positive one, but also an unqualified American identity, which in its manifestations is indeed an example for all the world, and which would have shown that this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. It could turn out that the proposed child family rights movement, tapping into a black reawakening triggered by a drive for a combined King Washington holiday, can help us to achieve this lofty goal. But it addresses a need for more immediate and concrete, our family breakdown. Yet in doing so, it speaks to this dream, a dream embedded in the life force of our race. These two leaders memorialized this dream in their famous speeches delivered in memory of the man who symbolizes our emancipation, Abraham Lincoln. African-American males have a special place in that dream and a special responsibility to give it life.
Now, Dr. Remsen, you mentioned three major demons that we're confronted with as African-American males. Could you explain those?
Yes, and I list the first as IQ lag. As you know, it's the notion that we're not a very smart people is deeply rooted in history and so on. And I unfortunately, I think many of us think of ourselves as not being very smart. We sometimes call one another dumb, etc. Well, this IQ lag creates a challenge for the school, and as we all know, many of our students are in special ed classes, and we have a disproportionate number who are and who lag behind the mainstream in terms of academic achievement. So this image of ourselves as not being very smart, and society not thinking of us as being very smart, is kind of a barrier for us. It creates a problem in how we feel about ourselves and how we respond to challenges that we face. The other is fatherless families. You know, we have a 72% of out-of-wedlock births. That's what we have. We have a lot of fatherless families. And crime has been a historical problem for us. It's not something new. The police shootings and so on, of course, is a present-day thing. But the underlying problem of crime with regard to our people is a historical one. And we've not done, frankly, a very good job of tackling that problem. So when I say IQ, fatherless families, and crime, those are the three things that kind of inhibit us from being the proud people that I think we ought to be. It inhibits our progress because we haven't confronted them. If we had confronted them, we can conquer them. Our IQ is quite sufficient for us to do quite well. See, but you have to work hard. If we're not quite as smart as some other people, we have to work harder than we do work. And we have to reverse the trend of fatherless families that started in the 1960s, mid-1950s, when our family structure was about on par with other groups. But somehow around the 1960s, it began to unravel. To the day that, you know, we have the situation where we have so many of our young men don't have fathers and don't have intact families. And as I say, crime has been historical. But we can do something about those demons. First of all, again, we have to acknowledge that we have them. And I think too many of us are in denial. It's factual information. It's not something dreamed up by the system or the white man or someone. It's factual information. And we can deal with it in a way that serves our best interest rather than evading it or denying it.
Okay, Dr. Grimson, I do want to jump in here. I want to make sure that I'm understanding you clearly. I'll just take one of the demons. You're saying that crime has historically been an African-American problem. Are you saying that African-Americans historically have committed more crimes than others? Or are you simply saying that African-Americans, as has been documented, are disproportionately imprisoned for their crimes? And as many projects like the Innocence Project are showing, frequently African-Americans are imprisoned at a greater rate, but it is because of race and also because of a system where money is made, there is money to be made to have people in prisons, and African-Americans are disproportionately the people who are, apprehended, jailed, and put in prison. So, I mean, I'm trying to separate what sounds like maybe an African-American proclivity towards criminal behavior against just the fact that due to racism and other factors, African-Americans may show up more in statistics about crime, African-Americans and also other people of color. So I just want to have that clarified, please.
Yeah. You know, I wouldn't use the word proclivity, but if you read the literature from the very beginning, once we got out of slavery, et cetera, et cetera, persons like Du Bois and Washington talked about the crime problem that we had. In Du Bois' classic, The Philadelphia Negro, he talks about the crime problem in Philadelphia, et cetera. And he talks about it in any number of other writings. So the crime problem has been with us for some time, quite aside from the concerns we have today about unfair incarceration. I would not use the word proclivity. I would say simply it has been with us. It's been part of our male culture for quite some time, historically speaking. For whatever reason, it's there. It's a matter of record. And I think it has to be addressed from that perspective, quite aside from the unfairness of the system per se. So does that clarify your do I have I answered your question?
Yes, you have. That's helpful. Okay. Mm-hmm. OV?
Okay.
Yeah. In short, I think we have a problem. We have to deal with it, quite aside from the legal and racial issues that have come before today.
In your book, you mention it's a self-published book, and you mention two main characters and schools of thought. One is a self-responsibility tradition vis-a-vis the responsibility for the system tradition. Could you explain that and elaborate a little bit on that?
Yes, and I see for the self-responsibility tradition, I see Booker T. Washington as being the father of that tradition. And his theme was brains, property, and character, emphasizing the things that we as a people must do for ourselves through an emphasis on brains, property, and character. On the other hand, Du Bois, who was his antagonist, kind of emphasized civil rights and the system, what the nation owes us. And his feeling was that unless we obtain our civil rights, we would be quite limited in what we could do on our own. He emphasized that. As that was his legacy on the system responsibility side. As I said, on the other side, the self-help side, Washington did not emphasize the burden of the nation. Rather, he emphasized our own responsibility for ourselves with help from the nation. But the emphasis was on what we needed to do for ourselves through pursuit of brains, property, and character. Du Bois' emphasis instead was on what the system needed to do for us in terms of enabling us to have those civil rights, as a result of which we would be able to pursue our ends and meet the objectives that he thought Washington wanted us to achieve, but we couldn't achieve unless we had our civil rights, in his view.
Okay. Do you feel that it's absolutely one or the other, or a blend of both?
Oh, I think it has to be a blend of both. And you see, I think it's unfortunate that the blend has not been in better proportion, because I think under the system responsibility tradition of Du Bois, we have not emphasized the self-help component to the degree that we should have emphasized it. So it's the imbalance that has been the problem, the imbalance. The balance since the death of Washington in 1915, that's when he died, and that's when Du Bois and the NAACP and the whole system responsibility tradition emerged into prominence. And that tradition has emphasized the system part, the civil rights part, and now getting an equal opportunity, et cetera. But you see, if we have the opportunities and don't take advantage of them, you see, we kind of nullifies the opportunities. And this is what Bill Cosby said in his pound cake speech a few years ago before the NAACP, that, we've gotten these rights and we've acquired these rights, but we haven't taken advantage of them. And this is partly what the book addresses. Oh, yes, we have the opportunities, but if we don't go to school, if we don't work hard, et cetera, then the opportunities are of no avail. So it's definitely a blend, and it's a matter of saying, okay, here are the opportunities. Now we must prepare ourselves to take advantage of them.
Do you?
And it has to be emphasized. It can't be something that we say one day and occasionally when we feel like it. It has to be a consistent theme, not one day and then occasionally. It has to be a gospel of here are opportunities. At the same time, we must take advantage of the opportunities in the same breath, so to speak.
Okay, Dr. Remsen, let me ask you something. Now, what you're saying, I think, in terms of what we want for our young people, what we want for ourselves, is no different than what many others before you have said. Every generation has, posits solutions, many solutions. Tell us a little bit about yourself, why you feel that, your solution might be better, more effective than others.
Well, it gets down, I think, to timing and implementation and so on. And I think one reason is that others might, I think, voice something similar to what I voice, but I haven't seen very many proposals that I find very credible as to how to get there. How do you achieve it? And I think we have to come up with realistic and practical solutions as to how to accomplish the ends that we similarly stand for. And I guess, therefore, I would say that a way that I differ from many that I've come across in the literature is that I have put forward some very concrete and specific proposals as to what to do, proposals for what the schools ought to do and proposals for what the community ought to do, and specifically the African-American males ought to do. And I haven't seen those specifics when I come across the proposals that some of the other people make whose ideas are similar to mine but don't come forward with concrete ideas.
I guess what I'm asking is, I know you have a background in education, and I'd like you to share that with our listeners, but have you, and because of your background, I think you might have been able to test this in ways that some others couldn't or haven't. So again, I would say, tell us about your background and have you tested this theory? Can you say that I've tried this, I've done this and that, and I've seen these results?
Mm-hmm. The primary experience on which I rely in conceiving the book and the foundation is what I call the African American Male Career Pathway Program. And when I was dean of students at Bronx Community College, speaking of my experience, I was dean of students there for a number of years. And I've been a public school teacher and headed special projects and so on. I have 41 years of experience in the field of education. Well, an important component of those experiences was an experimental program that I designed and administered for a minority male students at Bronx Community College, we had over some 200 students who over a two-year period enrolled in this program. And it was taught by African-American and Hispanic male counselors, and they were all male students. And we had a special course for the students, and they were given special help, etc. So from that program, it gave me an idea of what we can do with our male students, what we minority males can do with our own male students. And that requires a situation where we get them together as a group and work with them as a group. That is, we black males work with them as a group in a career and character building program. It was a career oriented. It gave them a chance to explore their career interests, et cetera, et cetera. And at the same time, they could discuss issues of daily concern to them and explore their needs on the day as they, you know, when they met, they could discuss things that were relevant in their lives, et cetera. So that we worked on their career exploration, on their personal needs and so on. As a result of which, the program showed some significant success on their part. Their grade accumulation was better than the control group. Their retention rate was better than the control group. Many improved their self-esteem, and they all had high praise for the program, both the counselors as well as the students, because they didn't have the opportunity before to with one another communicate and share ideas and problems and solutions, et cetera. And this program gave them a chance to do that. So my idea is that if we could do something like this on a larger scale, and that's what the book is about, and that's what I'm proposing, to try something like this with some modifications involved, but on a larger scale, test it out further. This was 5 years that I did it, so it didn't, you know. And the results are not conclusive, but they are indicative, I think, of what's possible. So we're going to try it out on a larger scale, and we can see what components work, what components don't work, et cetera, and then disseminate it in a way that we have males involved in a career, character-oriented program. And that's the key. We're talking about career and character. And by character, we mean things like emotional control. Can you manage your conduct? See, that's the issue that many of our young men fail who don't complete high school. They can't manage their conduct. They can't control their behavior. They can't persist in a task and do the hard work that school demands. Making those adaptations, and that's the reason it's called an adaptation crisis. They must adapt to the demands of the school, and they find it hard to do. And the program that I've designed and I propose is intended to help them do that, to assist them in adapting. And one of the major things we can do is, see, the career part is so important because everybody wants to be somebody and wants to feel important. And you know, they want to do, look, I'm a teacher, or, you know, I'm a minister, you know, I'm a doctor, or whatever. And many of our males don't acquire this sense of identity. A career program helps them to do that, helps them to explore, okay, what am I interested in? What am I capable of doing? So they maybe come to see themselves, I the carpenter, you see, I the teacher, I the counselor, and so on. And this gives them motivation, gives them something to work for. See, rather than having the mob of the people on the street who are selling drugs or doing whatever and they're not doing the right things, we expose them to the program of ideas, expose them to a variety of things. And it really is like opens up a whole new world for them. See, it isn't as they come up in communities whereby they have all these malls and they see all of these things.
You mentioned.
So the idea is to expose them to it and to have live people come in, people from our community come in, not from abroad. You know, have people come in and talk to them and interact with these people, serve as, do work study with them, et cetera, et cetera. So the program is geared around that.
Within this context, Dr. Ramson, you mentioned seven social economic variables, intact homes, basic education, post-secondary training, and once again, home ownership. And then you talk about poverty and crime. Could you elaborate a little bit on the solutions?
Okay. What and those are cited as adaptation requirements, and those are variables that can be used to measure how well a group or an individual has adapted. And how can we achieve them? That's what I've just been trying to describe. We can achieve them, I think, through an emphasis on career and character. And at bottom, let me kind of generalize this. We must provide better environments for our young males, females as well. The environment is the key to determining how well our sons and daughters turn out. We're talking about sons in this instance, of course. Given the right environment, most of them are going to do quite well. But they're not going to do quite well if we don't provide them stable and nurturing environments. Human beings need love and security and attention, particularly during infancy and while they're starting out. The research is very clear that if we bring up infants with a sense of security and with a sense of love, they are likely to develop the character traits that are necessary for them to be successful in school and in life. And that means being in a home that provides you a sense of security and a sense of love. You see, so how do you achieve those seven adaptation variables? You start with a family that is stable and sound and that provides their young, their infants, security and love. It's kind of rather basic and fundamental. It isn't as if there's some magic to it or anything, or if some group has a secret to it. We're talking about human nature. We're talking about what is true, at least across Western culture, that if we provide our youth these things, a sound family structure, we're going to get good results on those seven variables, and generally, because we will enable our sons and our daughters, as I say, to be successful in school as well as in life. You see, sometimes I think, because I think we met maybe what we think as of failures, et cetera, I think sometimes we think there is maybe some secret, something that we haven't discovered that other groups have. But it's kind of basic human nature. If society rests on the family, the foundation and the progress of society, of a community, rests on the soundness of the family. And we have not, that's the problem with the system responsibility tradition, in my view. Civil rights are very important. But unless on the other side, we, on the self-help part, have a stable family, we negate the value of the civil rights rather than being able to take advantage of them. And as the question was raised earlier, are they aligned? Do we have a balance? No, we don't have a balance. We have an imbalance, and we have an imbalance on the wrong side. I would rather have an imbalance on the self-help side than an imbalance on the civil rights side myself.
Okay, Dr. Remsen, well, yes. This has been the fastest 30 minutes that we've had in a long time. We're coming to the end of the program. We thank you so much for sharing your book with us. And for those of you who want to look for it, let me give you the title again. The African American School Adaptability Crisis, Its Source and Solution, Planted in the African American Garden of Eden. I hope that this book will reach it, you know, all the audiences that you want, but certainly ones who can join with you in this struggle. And again, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck with the book and with your programs. I think what you're looking for is what we all are. Thank you for joining us on Black Book Talk.
Thank both of you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is the close of the October edition. I should mention that our third party, Emma Jackson Ford, is not with us today. Emma's feeling a little bit under the weather, so we are wishing her warm thoughts for rest and recovery, and we invite all of you to join us in doing the same. We will be back next month. And until then, good reading to you. This is Patricia Welch, the library lady, signing out.
And O.B. Hill on Black Book Talk. Let's read, walk, and talk.
Oh, how I long to know the truth. There are times when I look back and I am haunted by my youth. All of my joy of today is that we can all
Shocks of Sheba has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. Welcome to Shocks of Sheba.
Gosh, man, come on, man. Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Allow myself to introduce myself. You know, buy some.
Sing it, sing it.
Sing it, sing it, sing it. Kirk, love the mama family. Yeah. Yeah, special request.